And welcome back. It's another episode of Dear Jane. I am Scott Baker, and she is Marcy Little. Marcy, how are you today?
I am so excited for this conversation.
Oh, yeah. This, you know, I'm really proud. We have some really kind of movers and shakers in the pro-life. We, you know, on the Dear Jane podcast here, we have a lot of people. We have some people you'd think, you know, you never hear from, we give voice to, and we love that. But we also have some high-profile people. And today we've got a real high-profile person that if you've ever been around the pro-life movement, you've heard of the name David B. Wright, and that's who we're talking to today.
But before we get into this conversation, don't forget to subscribe wherever you are listening today, whether that's YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, so you never miss an episode, and so you help other people find this great content on Dear Jane.
Let's get right to it. A lot of great things to talk about with the culture and the election and all these things. Our guest today is David B. Wright here on the Dear Jane podcast. Well, David, a big election is coming up on us here very, very quickly. And a lot of us pro-lifers find ourselves in a bit of a quandary. Let's just talk about presidential. There's no obvious great choice. How do you go about it? I mean, just when you start to consider political candidates, where's the pro-life issue rank for you? How's that calculus in your brain?
Oh my goodness! Wow, that's you're opening up a big can of worms here. So the pro-life issue is paramount. It's foundational. And I look at that from kind of two different perspectives. The first of those is look back to the founding of America. When our founding fathers declared independence, they recognized the right to life as the first foundational right before happiness, the pursuit of happiness or liberty, because they realized if you don't have a right to life, what else can you have? So just from a foundational standpoint of our American Democratic Republic, it's an understanding that life is foundational. But also from a faith perspective, to recognize that if we see in another person as believers, and I think most of us are, if we see in another person the image and the likeness of God, and we recognize that every single person is made, knit together in a mother's womb, in God's image and likeness, and is worthy of protection, and even many Christian faith traditions build their entire social teaching on the foundation of the dignity of the human person. So if we want to affect change, if we want to know what's a calculus that we can use when weighing candidates and policies as we go to the voting place, life has to be at the forefront of this. But as you said, Scott, right now we're in the situation where we've got one that is certainly worse than the other, but the other one that's saying some really troubling things and has taken some troubling actions. And we have to kind of say, okay, how do we now navigate this imperfect situation? And that's what I'm looking forward to rolling up our sleeves and diving into today.
Yeah. What would you say to just anyone who's been a part of the pro-life movement, whether that's for a long time or a short amount of time? I think a lot of us probably feel a little betrayed by the political system. Certainly one party has not helped in decades. Right. The other party, I feel like, has flirted with the pro-life movement, maybe courted the pro-life movement a little bit, and now it just feels like it's completely turned its back on us. So what are we to do with that when we think about casting a vote this year?
Yeah, that's a great question, Marcy. And I think first and foremost, for those of us who are people of faith, it leads us to our knees, right? We've got to pray. We've got to pray for wisdom, for guidance, for discernment in this situation. I'll give a few thoughts in a moment about what are some considerations that we can take. But when we look at the landscape, you know, we have essentially two candidates. One that comes from a party that has avowed its commitment to destroy human life through abortion, through all 9 months, and want to do this with taxpayer dollars with essentially no limitations. So we see with absolute clarity, okay, there's one party and one candidate that from a pro-life perspective, there seems to be absolutely no way to vote for that person or for that party that has those as foundational principles. Then we get to the other side. And we look at a party and even a candidate who had previously done some wonderful things to advance the pro-life movement. So why are we here today in a post-Roe landscape? It's because one of the candidates, while serving previously as president, nominated three justices to the U.S. Supreme Court who were ultimately confirmed to the court, and those three justices made up the majority that handed down the Dobbs versus Jackson decision that overturned Roe versus Wade. And by the grace of God, and we thank the good Lord and for all the efforts and people and time and money and organizations that got us to that point. But we also look and say, wait, what happened? So we have a couple of things that are troubling, and we're just going to have to navigate through it. So one is that candidate who is now running again. I don't know that we need to work around this without naming names, but I'm just trying to use general conceptual things that focus on the principles, not the personalities. That candidate is now saying, we did what everybody wanted. We sent it back to the states, which is, of course, what the Dobbs decision did. The Supreme Court said there was no constitutional right to abortion. It's now back to the people, you and me, the American people, through our elected officials in the states and in Congress. In Congress as well. So the candidate's saying now it's back to the states and there doesn't need to be any further federal action. Well, those of us who recognize that human life is sacred and needs to be protected and that abortion is a fundamental violation of that human right, we need to say, okay, we got to take every action that is possible. Can Congress do something? Yes. Can the president do something? Yes. Is the majority of the action going to take place right where we live in our hometowns and in our states? Absolutely. But there are still things that need to be done at the federal level. So we look at that and say, okay, that's concerning. But then also we look and say, what happened with the platform for that party? So the party that candidate represents previously had very, very solid planks or policy statements in their platform that talked about the dignity of human life and wanting equal protection for all. And it was beautiful. Now, did many candidates actually live by that in terms of their policy decisions coming from that party? The answer is no. But was it at least the aspiration of the party to live up to that higher standard? And the answer is yes. But what happened is during the platform committee this year, leading into the conventions, that policy, that platform position was watered down tremendously, stripping away a lot of those protections and just keeping it as a states' rights issue and simplifying it down, because that mirrored more what the candidate wanted to run on. Now, personally, I think the candidate got gun-shy because after the overturn of Roe, there was such a drastic backlash, which we're still witnessing, this visceral, emotional, dark underbelly of our nation that just came out of the woodwork to champion and support for abortion and advocate it in state ballot initiatives. But as a result of that, I think that candidate kind of wanted to back away and say, I don't want to be in the forefront of this issue anymore. But what are we to do? What are we to do? So I'll just, if I can, just offer a few quick thoughts on this. So going back to my first point of, we got to pray. That's the most important thing. The second thing is, when we go to the polls, we have a few decisions. One of those decisions, some people could say, I'm just not going to vote. I don't like either of the choices. Both of them have compromise and challenges. The one candidate's adamantly for abortion at all stages. The other one made questionable statements about Florida and other things. And so I just don't want to vote. That's not an option. I'm sorry, but as believers, we are called to be engaged in the civic process. We are called to render to Caesar what is Caesar's. We are called to go, and we are meant to be a part of the process of electing our leaders. So, first of all, don't sit this one out, and make sure nobody you know sits this one out. Number two, then, is if you go to the polls, which you need to, then you've got to say, how do I vote when I want to vote my conscience? Well, you've got to, first of all, in my view, look at it and say, is there an absolute no that there's non-negotiables, cannot possibly support a candidate or a party based on things that completely are anathema to my values, to the dignity of life, to my faith? And so initially you start there and say, who not to vote for? And I think in this election, there's an absolute clarity of a certainty of where not to vote, in my viewpoint, if the sanctity of life, if you share that foundational principle. But then you say, but there are people who are not so great, or even I think they're kind of bad, but they're not as bad. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at it at the long term and say, if that candidate who's really bad gets into office, more human lives will be lost. There could be a federal measure to enshrine abortion, similar to what Roe v. Wade did, but through congressional action. They will champion and support every ballot initiative to enshrine abortion in state constitutions. They will do everything to provide federal and state funding to abortion providers. Things will get really bad. More children will die. More women will be wounded. If instead we go to the certainly imperfect but less bad option, then fewer children will die, fewer women will be wounded, and fewer of these really devastating policies will be enacted. And so we've just got to weigh that calculus and consider that. The other thing is there's what a candidate campaigns on, and there's a different thing about what they govern. So even though a candidate, in my opinion, is trying to kind of avoid the criticism and the challenge of dealing with abortion in the forefront, their policy and their practice has been to appoint justices who at least recognize and acknowledge the dignity of human life. And I think we could probably expect more of that. They are going to not enact things that are worse. And maybe if something hits their desk, they will enact some things that are better. But that's why I think it's so important for us to have these conversations. And I'm so glad, Scott and Marcy, that you invited me here so we can think about it. We can go pray about it. We can talk with others. We can look at the candidates, look at the policy positions, and then go and with our vote that we must exercise, do the best we can to do the most good and to mitigate the worst damage that could possibly happen. So those are a number of thoughts that I consider when I go to the polling place.
There's a school of thought that I think a lot of politicians have bought into, that the pro-life issue in general is a political loser. It's detrimental to the political aspirations. And I think that's what we're seeing with Donald Trump. He's right. Saying probably some of the things he says because he's bought into that school of thought. Do you buy that? And if it's true, why do you think that's true?
I don't buy that. I think we are seeing a moment because the overturn of Roe where it's more difficult and more complex. But if you go back and look, I've worked closely over the years with the Susan B. Anthony List, now Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, Marjorie Dannenfelser's organization, and they have found time and time again when a candidate runs on a principled pro-life platform and position, they will in many more cases win than they will lose as a result of that position. So we can go back and look at a lot of elections, and that's in red, blue, purple states, everything in between. So historically, I would say that the problem has been people who have been running, candidates haven't known how to talk about it. They haven't known how to campaign about it. They've gotten caught in traps where they don't know how to address the wedge issues of rape or incest or life of the mother, or they're really not principled pro-life people. So they're just kind of pandering to the pro-life vote. And so when they get caught in a corner, they don't know how to navigate it. But when you have a strong candidate who is able to articulate the pro-life position and not only the position of the child in the womb, but also, do we care enough about women to help them in their time of need? I mean, a lot of us have in the pro-life movement have seen the data, even supported by the abortion industry, that says between 6 out of 10 and 7 out of 10 women who had abortions said if somebody had been willing to help them and provided resources to them, they would not have had an abortion. So can we, as a movement, as politicians, articulate that in a way to say we care about women and we want to offer them a better choice that doesn't come with a lifetime of regret? Can we support our pregnancy centers, our maternity ministries, other groups that are doing amazing life-saving work? Now, I mentioned this moment that we're in, and that's where things get complex. So as we all saw, when Roe v. Wade was overturned, there was this enormous backlash. And I think I was surprised, and most leaders and most advocates I talk with really were caught a little bit off guard by how visceral that response was. But I think it makes sense, because since the 1960s, the sexual revolution, the proliferation of contraception, and then the decriminalization of abortion, people began living lives with lifestyle choices that kind of all fit together, and in their minds necessitated we've got to have abortion as this option. And so when they perceived that option was being taken off the table, even though more abortions or comparable abortions are happening now than were happening before the overturn of Roe, they're just happening as people cross state lines and as male pills are coming into their mailbox, abortion pills. But there was this perception that something that I kind of wanted to have in my back pocket is being taken off the table. And so there was this backlash. That's why I think we saw over the first couple of years, 7 ballot initiatives, the pro-life movement won 0 of them. The abortion industry won 7. And we had devastating losses in Michigan and Ohio and other places. And right now we're facing 10 state ballot amendments, and this is what the abortion industry is resorting to now, trying to impose abortion through ballot amendments, many times with misleading language and many times tapping into that visceral emotion right now as rapidly as they can before people start to see, oh, wait, we actually can function as a nation, as a state, as a people without destroying the lives of our children and without wounding women for a lifetime through this destructive practice. So I think it's more important than ever. I don't think it's a losing issue, but I think it's more important than ever right now that we educate our candidates, we get involved in the civic process, we work with our local precincts, we work with our local party chapters and the national parties to help them understand how to articulate the dignity of human life better than ever. And frankly, I'm not saying this because you put me up to this, but Scott and Marcy, that's where I think Choose Life fits into this equation. And some of your incredible projects you're doing in Florida and elsewhere, because you are helping people know how to address the issue in the context of our current cultural landscape and climate. That is more important, to be able to measure the efficacy, the effectiveness, the impact of the messaging we're using, and then making sure that shapes the outcome. That's more important than ever. So it's not a losing proposition. We got to approach it more strategically with better messaging. And in my opinion, there's no one doing a better job of that right now than you right now.
We appreciate that. And we'll send you our check later. but I'm glad you said what you said about helping politicians and lawmakers in general learn how to talk about it. I believe, you know, we have an opportunity to visit with lawmakers all across the country. And I believe as a movement, we have done an exceptionally poor job at equipping our leaders with the information, the data, the facts, the stories, right, and helping them know how to talk about this. So that was one of the pieces of advice that you just gave us is, hey, help, you know, talk to your local candidates, that sort of thing. What should we, if somebody's listening right now, says, okay, you know, I've got a state Senate candidate, I want to make sure that they care about this. Mm-hmm. What are some general things that you would suggest that we give to them and help them along in understanding how to talk about this?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, let me just underscore the importance of talking to them about it. Because if you just sit back and bemoan the problem, you're not doing anything to help solve it. So it is critical that we engage with those who are on the forefront. I mean, case in point of this, just recently we saw the kind of concerning statements that Donald Trump was making about the Florida abortion ban. And there was the question of whether or not he would vote for the amendment to enshrine abortion. And there was a lot of angst about this. I know a couple of pro-life leaders who had access to either him in one case and some of his top people in another case. And they immediately called and they expressed in a charitable way, they expressed their concern with what was happening, expressed a principled way to be able to understand it, the support that the candidate would have if they altered it. And within 24 hours, Trump's position changed publicly. And he took some heat on that in the debate. So don't underestimate what expressing our viewpoint can do. The other thing that I would say is, you know, I've talked to elected officials from, you know, local city council and school board all the way up to U.S. senators and congressmen. And the one thing they always tell me is the most important way you can communicate with them to influence them is either in person or by phone. A lot of times we have these automated email systems and we flood their offices with emails and they usually just like have their staff just kind of put it all in a folder and say, how many for, how many against, that's it. They never even read them. But if you call an office of an elected official, I've had U.S. congressmen tell me that they had a landslide of calls coming into their office. And I said, really, how many? And it ended up being 11. But 11 people taking the time to pick up their phone and call their office and talk to them or their staff, to them was this onslaught of communication. So whether it's go to a town hall meeting, whether it's go to their office, either, you know, if they're a federal official in D.C. or back home where they work, or if it's a local official, go to them. So I just want to underscore, go talk to them. Now, if you say, what do I say to them? Well, first of all, like pray, right? We talked about that. And then just try to talk to them with a little bit of compassion, a little bit of empathy, but also help them think things through, because we want to assume that a candidate who's running and in some way is pandering to pro-lifers has as much experience as we do, right? But they don't work at Choose Life Marketing. They don't work with a local pregnancy center. They don't go out and pray at a local 40 Days for Life campaign. So most of us know more about the pro-life position, and we can take some of the great apologetics work that's out there by people like Stephanie Gray Connors or Scott Klusendorf, or some of the great materials that Choose Life Marketing has put together, work that Heartbeat International or CareNet or NIFLA have put together, and just take that information, think about what's relevant at that moment, and then take it to that person. And with that empathy and with that not confrontational, you're not trying to beat them over the head with it, but just share with them, here's what's at stake. The last thing I'll say on this, and I think this is really important, is the power of stories. The power of stories. So, you know, I keep right here on my desk, I wasn't even planning to use this, I keep two photos on my desk at all times to remind me of what's at stake in this debate. So this one is a young woman named Laura Hope Smith. And I met Laura's mom, Eileen, in Massachusetts back in 2007. And she gave me this card and she told me about her daughter's death. And what happened was Eileen, her mom and dad, who had adopted Laura, did not know that Laura was pregnant. She ended up going to an abortion center in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. And not only did the abortion end the life of her child, but she was butchered and killed and died on that abortion room table. And the first that Eileen and her husband knew that Laura had even been pregnant, let alone having an abortion, was when they got a call that their daughter had died. And so I always keep this picture here to remind me, abortion doesn't only hurt the child and destroy his or her life, but it also hurts the mother, the father, the family. That story Eileen has used and shared with so many people. And here it is, 17 years later, and I remember the key elements of that story, and I can share that with somebody and say, there's a face to what abortion really does to women. Was that choice? That's the destruction and the harm that's caused. So that's a story. The other picture I keep on my desk is this little boy. His name is Ja'Kai. He's no longer a little boy. But when I was leading 40 Days for Life for 2.5 years, Scott and Marcy, I had not met a single child that had been saved from abortion. I'd heard stories. I knew it was happening. I hadn't met one. And I was just longing. One day I wanted to meet a mom and a baby and know it was worth it. And I was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I was speaking at a pregnancy center banquet. And at the end, a woman got up and shared her testimony about how she had been going into the local abortion center and some people praying at the 40 Days for Life outside. One woman had a sign that said, "My abortion hurt me." And it was a woman named Karen. Karen was post-abortive and had always felt, how could I tell somebody not to do what I did? But she felt that day, I need to go. And she went with her handmade sign. The woman saw it. She ran over to Karen and said, "I was about to go in here, but I need a lot of help." And Karen took her to the local pregnancy center where those people came alongside that mother, provided help and hope and love. She chose life. And that night in Harrisburg, many years ago, I got to meet little baby Ja'Kai and hold him and meet his mother as she thanked me through her tears for what 40 Days for Life and these volunteers had meant to her. So I shared this story just recently. I was speaking at the Pennsylvania March for Life in Harrisburg. So I related the story since it related to Harrisburg. And unbeknownst to me, in the crowd was Karen, the woman who had been holding that sign. So I shared the story at the end of my little talk. I came down off the platform and she came running out of the crowd and she said, "David, I got to share with you." And she pulled up her phone and she shared me a picture that she had just been at Ja'Kai's 13th birthday party.
Wow.
And she shared the picture of her, Ja'Kai, and Ja'Kai's mother. And I just realized this work we do is not only about the babies, it's not only about the mothers, but we can have generational impact. So never underestimate whether it's your story. These aren't my stories, but I'm able to share these stories and they have an impact on others. Or if maybe you've been through the pain of an abortion and you're able to share, "I thought this was an answer, but it hurt me. It didn't help me." Those stories can soften and change hearts. The example of this I think of is Zell Miller. Zell Miller was the former governor of, I believe it was Georgia, and then a U.S. senator. And he was very pro-abortion, Democrat pro-abortion. And he heard testimonies of women who had had abortions sharing, "I regret my abortion." Completely transformed his life, and he became a pro-life Democrat and spent the rest of his political career championing life. But it was because of stories. So as we go, be informed, pray, share what we learn from great organizations, but also share stories that can help to touch the heart as well as the mind.
I think that's such an important point. I think too often in the pro-life movement, we're so passionate and we have all the stats and the numbers and we just want to convince people. But if we think about the way that we're touched, we're not, you know, stats I guess, depending on the stat, they can be touching sometimes, but they're never going to move people as much as stories. And so I think that's so powerful. As you survey the landscape, both culturally, politically, where do you see cause for hope? Where do you see our future going as a pro-life movement? Why should other people have reason to hope?
Yeah, I see enormous hope. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but I see enormous hope right now. And I lost count. I think I've been to 35 states just since the Dobbs decision came down. And so I've been working with leaders and groups and advocates on the front lines. And I've gotten to see some of the best scenarios, places like Texas or Tennessee, where, you know, virtually no abortions are happening within their state boundaries. But I've also been to places like New Mexico, where they went from 5 abortion centers to 15 in just over a month after the Dobbs decision. And everybody's flooding across the border from Texas. So there is a lot of change, and we need to adjust to that change. But I'll tell you a few of the spots that I see hope. I mean, first of all, I mean, if we are people of faith, we have to place our hope and our trust in God Almighty and His Son, Jesus Christ, our Savior. So that's where I find my greatest hope. You know, with man, any of this would seem impossible. With Him, all things are possible. So first, hope in Christ, hope in God. Secondly, is hope in the young, energetic, innovative new things that are being done. I love to see new ideas and some kind of people who've been doing pro-life the same way for a long period of time. They kind of see that as competition or a threat in some way. I'm like, no, this is great because everything that is new, it needs to be tested until we find what's working best. And in this new landscape, let's be honest, a lot of the things we've done historically as a movement are less and less impactful. I was just on the phone yesterday. I'm going to speak in Columbus, Ohio next week for a pregnancy center. And in their county, 87% of abortions are now committed through abortion pills. So the efforts we have historically done through prayer vigils at surgical abortion centers, sidewalk advocacy, and sidewalk counseling, while they're still important, they're less efficacious and impactful in those places versus where they were even 10 years ago. So we just have to be adapted to whatever the landscape leads us to. So I see young people, some of them through groups like Students for Life, some of them through rising up through the ranks of groups like Choose Life and other places. I see young, youthful, innovation, ideas, entrepreneurship that's bringing a lot of new ideas to the forefront. Another thing that I see happening that gives me hope is I see new levels of unity and collaboration that I've not seen before. So you used to have different pro-life groups did different pro-life things. And because everybody was kind of loosely aiming at, well, we got this big federal issue, Roe v. Wade, it was kind of, you know, everybody was kind of off doing their own thing. All of a sudden, when the landscape shifts and it's back to the states, I see groups across Missouri that are now working more collaboratively. They're doing marches together. They're strategizing. The pregnancy centers are networking. They're communicating with people on the other side of the border in Illinois, where people are going across the border to have abortions. And so the collaboration, that unity, I believe is crucial for this stage more than ever before. And I love to see some of the great progress that's happening. This is not a time for Lone Rangers. We don't have the luxury for that in this climate. This is a time for us to be united, collaborative, and working together. The third and the last thing I'll share is I have a lot of hope right now in the solutions that I see being offered to women in need. And that's something all of us, regardless of what part of the movement we're in, we need to come alongside women more than ever before who are the fear-mongering, all the noise in the media is putting them and their children at greater risk of abortion than ever. We need to be that other voice. I mentioned those studies, 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10 women said, if somebody would have helped me. Through our words, through our actions, through the work of Choose Life Marketing and pregnancy centers and maternity ministries, we need to be saying more than ever, I will help you, to that mother, because the only way we can save the child is if we reach through the mother and help her with her immediate needs. So I'm on the board of a maternity ministry, and we are bursting at the seams. We have 23 mothers we're housing right now. My wife is a mentor for some of them. I work with a lot of pregnancy centers. Like, this is the moment that we need to, as believers, show the love of Jesus Christ through our hands and through our feet. And this is the time where if we really mean what we've said all these years about we want to help women, we want to save children, now more than ever, we need you on the front lines. And that gives me hope because I'm seeing a huge growth in pregnancy assistance, pregnancy support networks, collaboration, innovation, and all that together. I think we're moving to some of our biggest victories we've had as a movement in the near future.
Here's what I would tell folks. If you ever get down, if you ever start to worry, just put this podcast on repeat. Just listen to David and you'll get fired up. Now I'm ready to go. I love that. You've really been encouraging. It is easy sometimes to see the size of the challenge, and yeah. and it is significant. But you've given us some real motivation and reasons to hope. So we're grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to thank you, and I really meant what I said. I, over these last few years, as I've become more acquainted with Choose Life and many of your other projects, even the Dear Jane podcast and Cogency and other things, I'm this is an example. Where do we find hope? It's you're doing exactly everything I just said. Innovation, new, youthful, energetic ideas. You're bringing them to the forefront. You're collaborating. You're building bridges and relationships with others. And you're doing this in a way that is meeting the needs of women and their children and directly saving lives. And I can't thank you enough for that. And for the person listening to not only be supportive of and engaged in Choose Life Marketing and all the other affiliated organizations and collaborative projects, but for you to ask yourself, how can I take these same principles? How can I take these examples? How can I bring them into either my fledgling steps of what I'm going to do to get involved in the pro-life movement? Or if I'm already doing a little bit, what more can I do? And how can I put these principles at play? There's an old statement I heard in sales years ago, which I think really bears repeating here. It said, tactics are many, principles are few. Tactics always change, principles never do. And today we're talking about principles, and we need to be principled. We need to have principles of lifting up and respecting and protecting every life, whether that's in how we vote, whether how we engage in the pro-life movement, whether it's in starting or growing or building an organization. Will the tactics change? Absolutely. It looks different today than it did right before the Dobbs decision, but we got to stick to our principles, and you are able to do that. Just follow the example of what you're learning here on the Dear Jane podcast, and you will be an effective force for good and save lives right where you live.
David, you've got your own podcast. Let's make sure we plug that. Where can people find that?
The best place is go to davidbewright.com, and that's a weird misspelled German word, mispronounced. So it's davidbewright.com. And so I'm just shifting from, I did a big event, a summit of 25 different speakers to kind of kick this off, and then I'm shifting it into a longer-term media project. And just to be able to share this hope and inspiration, just like you're doing here, I want people to know if you turn on the news, you get all depressed, you feel helpless, you feel powerless, there's good stuff happening, and we can be a part of it, and we can lead the change that our communities and our nation need right now more than ever. So davidbewright.com, come along on the journey and stay connected with the Dear Jane podcast.
Fired up, ready to go. David, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Dear Jane.
You bet. It's been a joy.
Thanks again for listening to Dear Jane.
You can follow along every day on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And make sure you also are subscribed so you never miss an episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. Ring that bell so you're notified and you never miss an episode.